Welcome to Bodcast, the Business of Dentistry podcast, brought to you by Practice Plan. Bodcast delivers the best business advice, real-life stories, and practical hints and tips to make your practice a more profitable and sustainable business.
I think primarily people will be interested to find out what's going on with the current prototypes and but exactly what practically it might mean when this rollout starts in a little over a year's time. So what are the pros and cons of prototype A and prototype B? Paul, I'll go to you first and see what you think about your prototype.
We're a prototype B, which means that our contract is more heavily weighted towards capitation. The official numbers are something like 83% based on list size and 17% based on activity. But most practices find that they don't actually... they have trouble delivering that activity. So most practices tend to fall down on the activity. So the way you get around that is by compensating by taking on more patients. So, and the way to make this work in practice really is to make sure that your numbers are really higher than the target, because that will compensate for the shortfall in activity. And the way that's worked in our practice is that, in a nutshell, it means that about 90% of our contract value comes down to capitation list size and about 10% down to activity. The pathway itself works pretty well. Patients get a good service. They get a lot more time with the dental team, particularly focusing on prevention. Most patients report that they give us good feedback on the quality of service that they're getting. So it's generally been very well received as an operating platform on the care pathway. The main problem with it really is down to the remuneration of it, and chiefly the involvement still of UDAs, which is a big criticism of the whole system.
So Ian, how do you find that? Because you're prototype A, so there's more emphasis on the activity.
More emphasis on the activity. For us as a practice, the decision to go into a pilot, so before the prototypes, that was easy for us because as a team, we've been, the way we worked as a team, we're half dentists, half therapists as it was. So the team mix was already in place, ready to move. So that was an easy decision for us to make. The move from pilot into prototype, that took a little bit more thought in terms of whether we were going to be able to make it work. Because to be honest, we weren't quite sure how we were going to manage the numerous targets, not just the activity, the capitation, but there's other outcomes as well that are being measured. And yes, it has been more of a challenge. Now, our experience has been, actually, that in order to be able to... that we've had to take on more patients to reach our capitation, that's no problem. But the knock-on effect of that has been, because they inevitably need more work, that actually our activity side, there's been a risk of us overshooting on that and over-delivering in terms of the activity. And so there's been a lot of plate spinning in terms of making sure we don't completely overshoot in terms of our activity whilst at the same time maintaining our capitation payments. It's kind of worked so far. There has been an effect on our waiting times. I think we've noticed for the first time that patients are now waiting longer to be seen because we're looking after more patients. Patients are waiting longer to be seen by individuals, particularly because we're controlling the diaries to make sure we don't over-deliver on the activity, because we're not going to do work we're not being paid for. So we've been fairly strict about that. So I would still say at this stage it still suits us better than being a pure UDA practice, old contract, but I think there have been some more challenges. I would agree, I think the clinical pathways actually work well. I think it gives a degree of clarity to patients, and it does give you another tool to allow patients to have a bit more of an ownership of their health, the responsibility they have. They know that unless they make certain changes, they're not going to be able to access certain levels of care, and that's entirely appropriate.
Ian, sorry, would you mind elaborating on that?
Okay,
because
so...
the oral health assessment and the RAG...
oral health assessment, okay, I mean, you end up with a score based on some of the social factors, so you're taking a record of a patient's diet, for example, and whether they smoke or not, all the things that we're all familiar with, and then there's actually the actual measurements that you see clinically, number of decayed teeth, number of active caries, lesions, degree of perio. So that all translates to the software will then generate the score. And that's a very useful communication tool, particularly new patients. You can show them, this is where you are. You know, and until these bits are under control, certainly, you know, we are able to say to the patients, look, until you get these bits under control, we're not able to invest a lot of time in some of the more advanced care until you brush your teeth, which is entirely appropriate. And so you are empowered to do that with the contract. It's not black and white, but it does allow you to do that and have those conversations more easily with the patients. So I think that's a good thing, and patients do walk away generally understanding what their role is. And there's no doubt from our patients that, you know, I thought we were fairly good when to look after patients in the perio. The care of patients, particularly on the perio side, has improved since we went into pilot and PDS. The care pathways have empowered us to do that. So I think some patients have benefited from that. And we have seen the changes in patients' periodontal health as a consequence of being specifically on the pathways. So I would say that side of it is actually quite good and quite useful. Another element of the contract is there are meant to be some quality outcome measures as well, and there was in theory some part of our contract value was linked to that. That's never come about. We've never really seen any money linked to that, and I think those measures are fundamentally flawed. But there is some attempt to have within the contract payment based on the outcomes of the treatment, not just the activity or the number of patients that you're seeing. That remains to be seen.
I'm just going to rewind a little bit and ask Paul, the oral health assessment, how have you found that? Ian's had a positive experience in terms of the communication, and the obvious question really around that, how much time does it take?
Yeah, to start with, when we first went into piloting back in 2011, we were booking 30 minutes per patient for an oral health assessment. But you learn to do it, and you get slick, and it's now down to 20 minutes. And I think that is generally the average time that most prototypes spend doing an oral health assessment. 20 minutes for a new patient. So during that time, you take your full history, social history, and all the other indicators that's just been mentioned. And then your next recall is called an oral health review. And then normally about 15 minutes for a patient. So it gives us time to review the patient, conduct another full examination, and also if there's some time left, we can do some treatment if it's simple treatment that needs doing at that point as well. The oral health review is programmed in there's an algorithm on the computer so that you book your oral health review at a specific time after your initial assessment. So if you've got a healthy patient with a green RAG score, so they're generally pretty healthy, you can extend out the recall period to maybe 12, 18 months or even 2 years. If they're a high needs patient, it will generate that the recall period should be shorter, maybe 6 months. And if the patients are an amber, then they will often have an interim care appointment, which doesn't have to be with a dentist. It might be with a therapist or a hygienist or an oral health educator. And that's generally geared towards prevention.
Eddie, I mean, we've heard two practical experiences from practice owners. Yeah. You'll get an overview of how the prototype A's and B's are going.
Yeah.
What's your sense of things?
I think from a BDA point of view, the type B is the one that we have preference for because of the fact that so much more of the payment is taken away from the UDA. There's still sort of UDAs, and the introduction of UDAs from the pilot back into the prototypes was definitely a retrograde step. Some of the practices that were going into mix of skills within their practice then had to revert back to actually recruiting more dentists to actually get them back in because the UDA element came back into it. I mean, some of the findings that we're seeing from the analysis is that probably if you're staying in, the average for a GDS practice is that 4 in 10 of you will face some sort of clawback at the end of this financial year. That's the figures that we're looking at. If you go into the prototypes, you're talking about 1 in 4 chance. So the element of working within a prototype is such that you still face a 1 in 4 chance of actually clawback, which to me doesn't look as though it's a successful system yet. And unless you tinker with it and make it right so that these numbers do match up, so that clawback becomes a thing of the past for people going into any reformed contract, I think we'd like to say, rather than a new contract.
Yeah.
Because if it becomes a new contract, they might have to put it out to tender like we're having in orthodontics at the moment, and I wouldn't want to go down that level or pathway. But you know, if you're developing a system like that, what we're seeing is for these people to make some of the prototypes work, they're having to work excessively long hours, they're having to recruit additional staff, they're spending a lot of extra money in actually delivering the service, simply to avoid clawback. There's people probably trying to do that in GDS practices as well. And we all know about the recruitment and retention issues, so it's not so easy to do. But if the calculations are wrong, and if the patient numbers are inflated, and we can all argue about what happened in 2005 to 2006, some of us will argue that the calculations that were done on UDAs at that particular point were deliberately inflated to make it harder to deliver. We were supposed to have a 4% reduction at that particular point. If that calculation of capitation is wrong for that practice, then a rollout is going to be really quite difficult for that practice to deliver on. If the calculations are right, so that if you work in a high-risk area, you are properly remunerated to look after a high-needs patient, then I can see some benefit in that, but I'm not seeing the evidence for that at the moment.
Eddie, you mentioned a little bit earlier about tinkering with the contract, and I suppose that tees up my next question, which is what lessons do you feel have been learned so far?
Well, worryingly, you know, if access drops, these types of practices have been eliminated from the system. So if you're analysing all the practices in the system and you take out all the ones that are failing, what you're left with is a successful system. But it doesn't mean to say it's successful. What it means is that you've got rid of all the ones it isn't going to work for. And if you're going to get rid of all the ones it's not going to work for, when you start rolling that out for 8,000 practices, you know, what are they going to do? They can't suddenly disappear out of it. I mean, there's even conversation at the moment now with the Department of Health where they're actually saying there will be no compulsion to actually go into the new system. You can stay with UDAs if you want to. I'm not sure anyone would really want to, but some people might want to, especially if you're on a particularly good UDA value. You might want to do that. And if you look at the calculations that are coming over because of that high UDA value, if you haven't got a population of patients that would balance up with that high UDA value, you're going to be expected to see quite a lot more patients. And they're making it harder for the patients to come in. I mean, a 15% rise in patients' charges in the last 3 years is a deterrent for people walking through your door. And there you're being judged on access, where they're moving the goalposts, making it more difficult to gain that access. I can quite predict that patient charges will go up again in April by another 5%. And we all know what's happening with our income. That's not going up. And you're having this discussion with a patient who's paying 20% more than they were 4 years ago, and they think it's going in your pocket. It's a very difficult situation, isn't it?
There's a number of questions that come out of that for me. One of them is around patient charge revenue, since you mentioned about patient charges. Ian, what's the state of play within the prototype contracts when it comes to PCR?
I'd have to say, Hannah, I'm not at the moment familiar with the latest figures on that. I think for us as a practice, we're pretty much as they were expecting. But we've got the strange situation that we are still being, the patient's still paying as if we were purely UDA practice. I think Eddie's right. I think there's not going to be they've said there's not going to be a big bang. And I can't say there would be, particularly because how would you manage the whole patient's charge system? That's never, ever been explained how that might work under a capitation system. The simple answer is, well, it couldn't really. You could not have a one practice, one town, you know, where patients were paying a monthly fee, whereas at another end of the street, patient are paying per UD. I can't see how that could possibly work. So I think it will be, like Eddie said, in 2020, a bit of a non-event. I think this reformed contract will be made available to area teams as an option for them to choose to have discussions with their practices, whether people want to go for it, and they'll be left at that. And we'll be left with UDAs for the foreseeable future.
I'll come in a sec, actually, to what a rollout might look like and what we might need to think around that. But Paul, it's one of the things that I sort of got from one of your answers about the use of the wider team and the whole importance of skill mix in making the contract work. And one of the questions that raises in my mind is linked to Eddie's point about how easy it will be to roll this contract out to everyone, as and when. But is size a factor in making the contract work? Do you need a big team to be able to have the flexibility?
I think it'd be very difficult for a single-handed practitioner to make it work, simply because it's there are too many factors involved, and I think you do need a reasonable-sized team to make it work. And that's probably the direction of travel with the wider NHS, and looking for, you know, doing larger practice contracts. With skill mixing, you know, there are a number of options available to you there. You can have a therapist, and the way it works in our practice is a therapist will do perio cases where they're BPE 3s and 4s, and she will do straightforward fillings as well. She won't do any fillings that involve occlusion, and so there's a combination there of what the therapist can do and also what the dentist can do. We also have oral health educators, so their chief role is doing plaque scores on perio patients and things like that, driving home the prevention message, and also doing fluoride treatments for children. So it does help to sort of filter out some of the simple stuff from dentists having to do that. And that opens up time for dentists to do the more complex work and also private work.
My guess is that's your experience as well, Ian, because I know therapists are an important part of your practice.
Yeah, absolutely. I have to say we never really got it to work in terms of oral health educators and nurses applying fluoride, only because it was just creating another appointment for the patient to attend. If the patient was coming out to see the therapist or some work, then we'd rely on the therapist to do, you know, the oral health education and apply the fluoride as well, so they come back for interim appointments. So, for example, with children, you know, the pathway would say child comes back in a year. I was always a little bit uncomfortable about a child going more than 6 months without being seen by a dentist, because we all know how things can go very wrong very quickly. But coming back to see a therapist who's been trained to obviously apply the fluoride, but has also been trained in caries diagnosis, which they're perfectly capable of doing, more capable than many dentists. Often the therapist spots things that we've missed. I'm very happy for that child to come back in and for an interim appointment, see a therapist. They get the teeth looked at, they get the fluoride applied, they get a discussion about toothbrushing as appropriate, no problem at all. That child's been looked after very well before their next examination in a further six months' time. So I agree with that. I think single-handed practice, I can't say I would work, but a practice with two surgeries, one dentist, one therapist, from our experience, the amount of work that's generated by seeing a body of patients that can be delivered effectively by a therapist in terms of the routine care or the perio, then one-to-one actually seems about right. Based on our experience in terms of how far our diaries are booked ahead when we've got half dentist, half therapist, we're both, it does vary, but we're both kind of working at the same, you know, diary in terms of how far we booked ahead. So that to us is an indication that balance is about right. And that's certainly borne out by some of the other research that's been done in terms of workforce planning as well. So I agree there is an economies of scale, but I would, you know, to my mind, even as two surgery practice with a little bit of work could possibly make it work with a principal employing a therapist to deliver a lot of the routine care. And economically, that would probably make some sense as well.
Paul, you wanted to...
Yeah, having said that, there are managerial conditions that you have to attach to that. So it's getting, as Ian says, getting the balance right between the various operators. We haven't found that a one-to-one works for us. We have three associates who predominantly do NHS work, and we have a full-time therapist. And she was very busy to start with, but over time we found that her book started to get quiet. And the other thing with oral health educators is you can open a book for an oral health educator all day long, but most of the patients, because of if they're children, they will only want to come after school time.
Absolutely.
So if you want an appointment with an oral health educator after school, you've got to wait 6 months. But if you want one in school time, you can have an appointment next week. So there are other managerial difficulties and challenges with operating skill mix, which you don't first appreciate before you get into it.